like a resurrection and a future, bright future that paradoxically Paphnutius was leading the audience towards.
That comes over definitely. Mm. A bright end.
Yeah.
Talking of hope as well.
So we weren't really able to embrace that yesterday. We were sort of staying quite a long way away from it. But then I think with the culmination of hearing papers and discussing it with people, it seemed like it's an ecstatic ending, which is what we were looking for today.
Your wonderful paper this morning, I was very struck on page 127 when it says, "God has not pardoned you for your valiant expiation, so much as for the love with which you have given yourself to Christ." And I think you were illuminating that in your paper about how, you know, it resonated so much with Christopher St. John and how the play, you know, answered her own ideals. And I think having heard your paper, it becomes all the more apparent.
Absolutely. I think the ecstatic moment is a huge thing in all these, dissident sexual engagements with that kind of homosexual spirituality. And the ecstatic moment is something that's yearned towards, and it's this expression of something that's almost, it's internal, but also a kind of throwing off, like an externalization of this rapturous moment, which is, it can really function as standing for something else, which I think was really brought through by the reading. Thank you.
I wasn't at the reading yesterday, but hearing it read, I was wondering all the time how much there was actually a double drama going on. So on the one hand, you've got the salvation of Thais, but on the other hand, we have this very dubious character. Mm-hmm. Who is he? I mean, she comes to salvation through him, but actually, isn't the play constantly questioning, what is this guy up to? Mm-hmm. You know, he's a definitely weird character. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And I don't think that's just a 21st century view. I think that that's implicit within the way he reacts with the disciples, you know, as we were saying beforehand, you know, how are the disciples, are they with him, are they against him, are they just bemused by him? And his continuing sense of self-glorification. And then you think, God, Christ had to come and save that poor woman from his horrible punishment. Actually, are we looking at his damnation as well as at her salvation? And that's really kind of curious. It's difficult to know, isn't it, unless you go further and really try and stage it, because actually, in the staging, a lot of that will have to come across, won't it? If it has a successful staging, how is it going to work?
Mm. I think it's even stronger when you, and I absolutely agree, I think it brings another resonance when you think about it in reference to the suffragette movement. And there's that moment which really stood out for me in the reading of it, which is to do with, she says something like, how will I, if I can't find a little clean spot to pray to God from a little clean spot in this cell, like basically it's going to get totally disgusting because she's going to be living there for 3 years with no means of doing anything other than living there for 3 years. And I, at that moment, was really sort of struck afresh by those horrendous pictures of the suffragettes being force-fed and that sort of thing. And it for me, it kind of juxtaposed in my mind, and I felt that moment incredibly kind of moving and powerful, I think.
Yeah, and Paphnutius at that moment is incredibly peremptory to the abbess. He said, get her in there, quick, you know, let's bang her in. And it felt that he was incredibly authoritarian at that time. And I also felt... in the previous discussions we were talking about, that this paradox within the demonization of women by men, and you know, they're constant objects of desire, and yet men will then blame women and accuse them, so that they're constantly deflecting their own shortcomings onto the women. So I thought that Paphnutius is an incredibly complex and troubling figure.
I mean, if you take it as Paphnutius is a troubling figure, and that Thais is invited to have an ecstatic transition from this earth into heaven, then it's a fully embodied celebration of Thais's kind of achievement, really. I think in the reading she comes over very unhampered and very almost like a clean character right from the start, and she engages with the activity that's it is forced on her, so that's very difficult, but the actual outcome is an award that she obviously embraces, and there seems to be ownership and agency in that. I was wondering for Danielle, who'd played Thais, what it felt like reading it today. Come to the mic so you get you.
It felt quite empowering, actually. I wasn't at the reading yesterday, but she seems to hold herself all the way through. And I think that's quite good to have a strong woman in such an old play.
Mm.
I was quite interested in that Aristotelian thing that was mentioned earlier this morning, because Tyrus at the end seems to dissolve into the earth.
Mm.
You know, she becomes,
yes,
her fingers,
right,
are like budding and twigs, and
yeah,
that her body transforms into the material world.
Mm.
And I suppose if it is an Aristotelian view and that's been taken out, God being immanent within the natural world, you know, the material world sort of having that substance in it, that divine substance in it, then it becomes much more complicated,
mm,
the body and its relationship to God.
Mm. And for Rotzwitz as a nun, I mean, that would be her preferred option, wouldn't it, to exit the world with that level of sort of ecstasy. And it felt like her voice was speaking through that piece today, I felt.
It's interesting. I earlier today, I and it was reinforced in the reading. I don't know why, but it reminded me of Yeats's Countess Kathleen, and the end of the play when it talks about her, because she's had to sell her soul to the devil to save the peasantry who are dying of famine, and it talks about how she has passed to the floors of peace. And there are these incredible lines about the years like great black oxen tread the world, and God the herdsman goads them on behind, and we are broken by their passing feet. And it seemed a similar sort of energy at the end of both plays to me. And I mean, I have no idea whether Yeats was aware of this play at that time, or, but it was just very, very interesting.
Yes.
I'm just wondering, maybe someone's mentioned this before, because I've read all the other sections, but how aware would an audience in 1914 have been of the Massenet opera version of this, or the Anatole France novel on which it's based, on which Paphnutius, who is called something else in the opera, is very clearly a dubious character and is erotically obsessed with Thais. And I think ends by telling her that all this Christian stuff is all illusion, or that she was right first time on that pleasure. I mean, would that have been something that they had sort of in the back of their minds as they were watching this version?
Do you think so?
In a review, in a newspaper review, there is a connection made with Massenet, and also the other author who's much earlier on, whose name just escaped me, but there is a reference, so I think people would have made that connection.
And on the music as well, especially at the beginning, and there's a lot of talking about the three sections of music.
Mm.
One can imagine that on stage and the staging in the direction, the kind of music that might have been happening on that production.
Mm.
I think there's a mention of Plain Chant, and I think there's a reverend who writes to E.D. talking after some time that he would give us some advice on how to do Plain Chant. That was some music was going on. There must be another music going on. So that early start of setting that scene must have been quite interesting with the talking, and presumably the music being intricate into the production throughout.
And the music could guide the response, couldn't it? Because if there's a certain kind
of
music at the beginning,
time,
then there's a music associated with the flesh pots. What's the music of salvation?
Mm.
That must be an interesting choice for staging, wasn't it?
Mm. And I think there was a choir.
Mm.
I'm going to call it bellow, but it's not. I think it's bellow. And stop. There's a choir that I know was actually doing stuff. I think the opera house around the corner at the time. So there would have been an involvement in quite the orchestra, but it's actually the choir that's involved in that as well.
So there'd be much more of a sort of it would reference church music as well, wouldn't it? And spatially, there would probably be a distance between different parts of activities, and the chorus would be staged, because I think that was very interesting, hearing about the plan to put it in the wrestling, in the sports hall. I mean, that is really what we'd consider to be site-specific performance now, which Craig was quite an early an early, that was one of her approaches, which was really early. But I think the sound is really important, and obviously references to number and sound at the beginning of the script, and I would think would sort of conjure up much more spiritual, sort of epic, otherworldly quality to it.
Because I know at the National Sports Club, obviously the boxing rings.
Mm, yes, that's right.
There's a picture up there of the boxing going on, but there's a proscenium arch behind it. It's a painting from 1918.
Mm.
And you could imagine this taking place, and the important thing I think she knew was that she wanted an apron stage.
Mm.
And that's what she gets at the Savoy.
Mm.
She's very clever. She knows that staging is possible. And the production that they're producing at the time is A Midsummer Night's Dream.
The
designer, Norman Wilkinson. And what works is that she knows she works brilliantly with curtains. And that set is almost entirely curtains.
Mm-hmm.
And at such short notice to go from... from the
wrestling
sports club down to the Savoy, she's already aware of what that show's looking like, and she knows she can adapt that.
Mm.
I'm just curious as well, I'd love to know how the cell, because it's mentioned so many times, a narrow cell is put on stage, or how she would...
And was that the grey light? Was that to do with the grey light, do you think, Catherine? The small cell.
There's only this
one reference to a grey light.
A grey light. On stage, so I don't know whether it would have been sort of symbolically symbolised on stage, or whether it would have been a structure or using curtains or whatever. It's very frustrating that the reviews don't
give more
information we really want about what it would look like. It's very fleeting glimpses.
But what we do know is that we'd see Pius' room with all the lovers that we read today, but that would be with dancers and really a play within a play in this piece, and highly entertaining and offering the audience a lot of spectacle.
I wonder about the cell. The cell is like a recurring emblem in modernist theatre. There are millions of them. Generally to do with either kind of entrapment of the mind or trying to get a kind of politically charged model. And it's especially right from like expressionism, which, as we read, I made way more connections with kind of the expressionist model. And so I had the back of my mind, you're talking about the cell, I had the back of my mind, Oscar Kokoschka's Murder, A Hope of Womankind, which is like, in a sense, kind of the polar opposite of this play, in terms of gender anyways. But it has this sort of cell at the very centre of it, and it gets entrapped in this barred cage, and I have in my mind that it's sort of similar to that. I don't know if Craig was aware of Kokoschka particularly, but it feels to me as if it's really, as if you could anyways connect to a really interesting expressionist tradition of building prisons on stage.
Mm.
And that ecstatic moment as well, which is of course absolutely key to what expressionism is all about.
Interesting.
Just a couple of other interesting resonances for me is that Antony of Egypt and Antony the Abbot and Paul of Egypt, you know, desert fathers, these are seminal, I use the word advisedly, fathers within the church tradition. And I think it's very, very interesting that this takes place with these seminal patristic authority figures who, and of course Antony Abbot inspired the whole monastic movement. And that's something that's interesting. And then another early resonance within the church was with those people who lived on the pillars, like Simeon Stylites. And just another sort of modernist take on that is Dali, his surrealist film. I don't know if anyone's seen that, but that's a very interesting response to this period as well.
I wonder, sorry, I have a question sort of for all of us as disciples, because I wonder if anyone felt something that we talked about before we started, actually, but something that I certainly felt all the way through, that I was trying to get the tone right of how you were supposed to speak the lines, and they're so incredibly ambiguous.
Mm.
And we actually all did them in really, really different ways, which I thought was really, just kind of really interesting. Just we spontaneously responded to what was in front of us. So I wondered if any of us had any thoughts about what the disciples are there for and what their actual response to Paphnutius is. Are they trying to like mock him or support him or follow him? Or did you get any sense of that in the dialogue at all?
Well, we talked yesterday, didn't we, about the different gears that the opening exchange goes through, where there's that discourse on music, which
exactly.
Everyone was following avidly. And then everyone starts laughing and that sort of thing, and it moves on to a more serious tone. But it is difficult, but for me, it just seemed like the disciples were acting as a more general chorus, you know, like from the sort of like from the Greek tradition. But it's interesting. I'm not going to claim this one for myself. There's a little footnote on the script if anyone's seen it. But it says that the disciples, as you read it, they were allotted to several different actors, with the interesting result that some definite characters emerged. And it was interesting, particularly yesterday when we went through it, that the character that I kept cropping up with was someone who was just completely dumbfounded by everything and didn't understand.
Mm.
And there were slight modulations on that across the different characters. Mm. So it's actually a lot more subtle than just saying it's a chorus.
Yeah.
A chorus
it was
role.
Easier yesterday to get the relationship between Paphnutius and the chorus, because by putting you back there, we weren't able to listen quite as much. But I think that the disciples are definitely learning from him, and also this trait of them being individuals, I think, is part of the comedy of the piece as well. So it's almost like the players. It's another sort of company in the piece, in the way that it's structured. And they comment on the action. And I don't know how many disciples they would have used, but we seem to cover the roles fairly comfortably, I think. So this may be something in terms of how many people would have been on stage. But it's an early ensemble, really. I mean, that's the thing. And you can swap and change the roles as and when required. And it only emerged really today to put the three up there, and because we had technical requirements, we had to work out how we were going to capture this for recording, and that became a priority when we came in here, really. So it's been an interesting process, but it would be really good to now be able to work on it in the space and see where that took it, I think, and also of course how you would deal with it for a 21st century audience, because when we did Pageant, A Great Woman, we found ways of dealing with that for a 21st century audience. And I think there's lots of resonance. We talked about the stoning of the recent woman in the news, and the Indian recent horrific event and all that. But actually, I'm not sure if those are the references that we'd use for this. And I was thinking with one of the papers on queer readings of this piece, the feminist group Femen, the ones that take their tops off and then write slogans on their bare chests, that seems more the sort of language that this piece has, because it's also a bit Marina Abramovich. The sort of durational side of how Tyus has to stay in this cell and what that means about her sort of performance of her own life is interesting, I think. Mm. Catherine?
Lady Constance Lytton, quite a famous suffragette. You probably know about the story that she was imprisoned, deliberately provoked arrest and imprisonment, and then felt that she'd been treated preferentially because of being
an aristocrat. Yes, that's right.
Deliberately poses as a working class seamstress, and then gets arrested to test out whether her assumptions were correct. But during her imprisonment, she actually started to carve votes for women on her chest.
Yeah.
I can't remember what she does it with, but some implement.
Yeah.
I think it doesn't go beyond V. This is described in her autobiography, but it is literally, you know, this
embodied
attempt to use the body as a form of protest, because there's no other means, and they were treated in such an abominable way when imprisoned, and I think that's just an interesting sort of connection actually with Marina around
yeah.
it.
Mm, very much so.
The most extreme kind of performance. And I think the imprisonment of Tunnies in this play, you know, there would have to be some means of, you know, really creating a horrified response if, you know, if it had an audience. Because we don't know whether it was ever performed.
In the 10th century
yeah,
to an audience. No, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I think, yeah, I think the Tunnies thing is interesting, just because of two extremes. I realise I'm just listening to you, because we've got her as a working woman, and the sort of rhetoric around working women, English collective prostitutes, that kind of view of working women, which is an extreme, and then the extreme of her becoming the pure soul that can transcend. So there's definitely a lot to work with.
Yeah. I was saying earlier that in 1922 there's a fascinating film which is in the library here, Hexen, the Witch, Scandinavian film, and it has a very interesting parallel between the witch craze and the persecution of women for as being witches, and there's lots of sexual politics within that, and then the incarceration of women as hysterics in the early 20th century, which I thought that just was something that resonated with me. And
no,
I mentioned,
yeah, I think that's absolutely true.
Yeah, I mentioned yesterday in the discussion and brought it up tangentially in my paper today, the temptation of Saint Anthony is one of the most well-known images of Christian art. You know, you have Anthony Abbott being leered over by all these lusty women and monsters
wonderful.
And devils clawing at him. And it just seemed to me, though, that I was fascinated today in this seeming tension within the suffragette movement of... a strong sense of obviously idealism and a sense of virtue, and then this queer politics and an alterity. Because this play, if that is present, then Paphnutius is incredibly malevolent, because obviously he's only coming out with an orthodox position of demonising female sexuality. And also his authority is ever present. He talks about his disciples as children, so there's a sense of infantilizing going on as well. So there are lots of very rich strains within the piece.
I think it would be good just to ask the students how you found it. I mean, you've read it twice now, and particularly with the final, we had a final presentation today about working with the work of this author with students, and how, I mean, has it got any relevance to you in terms of, is it something that you'd like to pursue some work on, or is it something that's better left on the library shelf?
No, it's certainly very interesting, especially on the second reading, getting the hang of it and then connecting it with the suffragette movement and other things today that are going on in the modern world. You can see it connecting, and that's something that you very much get on the second full reading as opposed to the first. We were just getting used to it. So yeah, it became more interesting today for me than it did yesterday.
That's good to hear. What about anybody else?
Yeah, I agree with everything that James has said there. The first reading was a little bit difficult without some context. But having read it today and listening to the discussions that people are having on it, there's a lot more depth to it than I got in with the first reading. But I do think that if anybody picked it up, if it was just in the library, if anybody picked it up and just read it, I'm sure they'd put it back on the shelf. But
probably. Does the action, the fact that it's not realistically or naturalistically structured play, worry you, the students? Does it worry you, or are you happy that the activity makes sharp shifts from one set of activities and context to another one, without really explaining what's happening?
It doesn't worry me as a student.
I think that's quite contemporary about it. I think it's interesting the way that it's choppy and juxtaposed.
There are
one.
Other plays, modern plays, where we can, or not so modern plays, I mean, Shakespeare, occasionally you jump from one place to another. You can jump time very quickly. So we're quite used to plays not having a very naturalistic sort of structure between scenes. So no, that wouldn't be a worry for me.
That takes us back in a way to the question about tone at the beginning, because I was thinking, what tone are these disciples? And then I was thinking, as we were reading, we were all taking different positions in a way. Actually, these are multiple tones, they're intrinsically multiple tones, and is that then a kind of way of signalling to the audience, don't think there's one position going on here. There are actually multiple perspectives, it's a fragmented perspective. And then when you talk about Paphnutius' authority, well actually I was wondering all the way through, has this guy got any authority? Because if she plays that she's playing with him, why should we take it that she's serious? Why should she be serious until the moment she decides for herself, I will go into that cell and see what happens? Otherwise she could be playing him along. Because there's nothing there to tell us that she's not playing him along. We're reading it as a very serious medieval, you know, kind of religious play. But perhaps, you know, having some of those things that you were telling us earlier, you know, think about medieval ideas, thinking about medieval cathedrals. Nothing in medieval world is sober and serious like that. So why should it be like that? I mean, I'm not saying it is or isn't, I don't know. But I'm wondering if part of that thing about the disciples says, turn it around, turn it upside down, move it this way, move it that way, so that you're constantly having to shift your ground and try and decide, and not actually be able to really come up with a solid answer anyway.
Can I just add something to that, which you've reminded me of? I was thinking, when we were talking about where this text came from, the 10th century, that it might well have been improvised, and that it might have been different each time, because that's a trait that Shakespearean plays have in the multiple folios. So if we were that bunch of actors or people who worked with Rotsfeld on this, we might have done it multiple times. We might be quite familiar with it, and it would become more of a chant. And I think that that's where the music comes in, because it is in, it's not prose, it's in verse, and it's got a particular kind of way. And we weren't really able to share any of that with you. And I just make that as a note, because of the, of this technology, and also because of the time. So I think if you were to if we were to take it forward, that would be something that we'd want to investigate. Actually, is how this is embodied. Really, because we're very stuck here.
What you've just said, of course, about this text being, as it were, the result of some sort
repetitive, creative
process, of course, presupposes that, well, that there was a process, and you know, that there was some sort of however you describe it, really, sort of an enacting tradition in a Benedictine nunnery in the 10th century in Germany. And I mean, people have talked about this being a play, and of course, in one sense, it has become a play because you have chosen to perform in this way. But I must say that I find that I think we have to be cautious about that, very cautious indeed, because there is, as far as I know, no evidence for any form of dramatic activity like that in the 10th century. And I think that this sort of text can be, you know, interpreted in the context of the 10th century as, you know, what become hundreds or perhaps even thousands of medieval texts which are designed to show the forgiveness of God, that, you know, whoever you may be and however you have sinned, whatever you have done in your life, there is a point at which God's forgiveness will come to you as well. And in that context, you know, this story and the other ones that are written as dialogues belong together with Rosita's hagiographies, to demonstrate that same point. And the other thing is that, you know, she in the introduction, she refers to what she's doing, and she refers to the playwright Terence. You see, now we know that Terence was a playwright. we know about plays and so forth. But I think that we have to. We can't be certain that she knew what a play was, And what she has is a text which is written as a dialogue.
Mm.
And that's what she's copying, because you know she knows that you know they're interesting things to read, but of course a lot of them are not the things which Christians ought to be reading, because they're about lewd and lascivious activities. And she's provided, as it were, an alternative which will be just as interesting to read, but will be good for you as well.
It's
just worth responding to that, though, that many texts were written aloud. So, I mean, and there is a whole body of work on theatre emerging from churches. I don't quite know about the 10th century, but certainly, but antiphonal, you know, responses within the church liturgy, that's obviously one source of a dramatic tradition. I mean, one of the earliest ones that we all talk about is the quem queritas trope, you know, whom do you seek? And this was performed within the church. He's not here, he's risen, all of that sort of stuff. So, but certainly lots of texts were read, and they were read to an audience.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a performative aspect. I don't know about this, I haven't studied it, but it could well have been that it was performed, but certainly it would have been read in a performative way. I think you can make that case. But I think Veronica might know more than I do. I don't know if Veronica wants to say anything about that. No.
I don't know about any potential performance.
I mean, there are plenty of texts, obviously, which are the result of, as it were, a sort of concretization of an oral tradition. But my understanding is that in the Germanic context, the oral tradition is not one which then produces Latin texts.
Mm-hmm.
We remember this is a woman who writes Leonine hexameters. You know, she has, we heard about the history of the deeds of the Emperor and so on.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's separate.
Mm.
Can I play
really
devil's advocate
slightly? Yeah, do.
What, because I'm really interested in this, I'm not a medievalist at all, what difference does it make to how we now respond to the work that's in our hands currently if it's not meant to be a play originally? You kind of use the word we need to be careful when approaching these plays, which I kind of half second and half go, and I'm interested in what that means actually in practice. Does that mean that we have to kind of go, oh, hold on, actually maybe we shouldn't think about this performatively, or what difference does that make to how, for example, us sitting here makes responds to
practically
my text?
Practically none at all.
Right.
Except that unless you are wanting to see it in some sort of particular historical tradition.
Sure.
It's like music. You know, a composer writes something in the 17th century, and you know the instruments are of a particular type, and the performance traditions of a particular type. When we get it now, there are new instruments, new ways of playing them, and it has to work for us now as well, because we can only hear the music through the ears that we've got, not through the ears that people had in the 17th century. And so in the end, what we do with the words is that's something for people now, for people in the future to determine, just as you know they do with Shakespeare or whatever.
Yeah.
So you know, go ahead. You all sit there.
But I wonder how many accounts do we have of day-to-day life in 10th century convents? Why would they write down? You see, if what people are saying is, and which is likely, because it's hard to think of a society that doesn't have performativity as part of its essence. Then if people did have performances and then wrote down the consequence of the performance, then what we're getting is some sort of reflection of that.
Mm-hmm.
Why would they have written about performance? Do you see, it's a completely difficult question to answer.
Yeah.
Yes, Catherine.
In the handout that I circulated earlier on, there's a short story called The Nun, and formally it's very unusual. There's lots of unattributed direct speech. So you've got a dialogue going on. There are three characters. They're quite quite hard to identify. Eventually you do get the names, but the experience of reading the short story is of trying to figure out who is speaking to whom, and I wonder whether that could ever have been performed.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing I did note, it was actually published in a women's suffrage newspaper, so there are quite a few plays that I missed when I first did my research reading through the suffrage newspapers, because I didn't recognise what I was seeing on the page as a play.
Mm-hmm.
But then subsequently found reviews of with the same title, and then finding these texts, so we've got a written text, and trying to figure out what kind of form you have.
Mm.
You know, there are sort of
lots of questions
still arising,
yeah,
around 1910.
Yes, that's right.
1912, and some suffragettes imprisoned would I think it was happened in Holloway. They recited Mrs. Pethick Lawrence recites Three Dreams in the Desert by Olive Schreiner, which is a short story, but everybody knows it off by heart. And all the other women are sort of sitting around, she's reciting it, and how amazing it was. And Lady Constance Lytton writes in her autobiography about how moving this experience was, and actually literature, therefore, she had changed her mind about how important it was, having had this experience in prison, and having heard this story being recited. And I think that's how a sort of a performance aspect to it, as an audience, as somebody reciting something. But actually, we would see it as a short story.
Mm.
That's how it's published.
Mm. Mm. That's very interesting. Thank you. So are we on our way to wrapping up now?
Yeah.
Yes, good. And do you want to come and...
Yeah, I think we just really want to thank everybody for what's been a really... you know, fascinating day. Lots of really varied papers, papers given, you know, in the immediate time and space, and some beamed in through Skype. We've covered actually several hundred years, as well as looking at 1914, 10th century, and then today. And I had no idea what was going to happen with the reading. I think you did it brilliantly. Timing and the tone and the different characters that emerged with the different tones of voice. So I think given we only had a practice reading yesterday with some people, not everybody, you know, it's been really, really interesting. And also from everybody in the audience, sort of comments and questions throughout the day. So thank you. And I'm really glad you were able to record it, because I've had conferences before where we've had really exciting discussions right at the end, and then we haven't had a record of it, which has been quite frustrating. So after today, we're going to be hoping to put this on the university website, so you'll be able to revisit it. And we're also hoping to publish the papers, and so you know, we'll put some information about that, hope that we get a publisher interested, and we can publish them and sort of share information, raise questions about Rot's Feet, or Rot's Feet, and whether it was a play or what kind of text it was, and what it means today, and the significance of women in theatre and gender performance, and you know, how many people perhaps out there perhaps ought to know about Rot's Feet and Christopher St. John and Edith Crane and all the other people involved whose names we're not mentioning, because there are more people than that involved in the production. So thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.